This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Queen of Fire by Anthony Ryan. Read for you by Stephen Brand. Part 1. The raven knows no rest, his shadow ceaseless upon the earth. Sjordar Poem, author unknown. Vernier's Account. He was waiting on the wharf when I arrived with my prisoner in tow, standing tall as always, angular features turned towards the horizon, his cloak wrapped tight against the seaward chill. My initial puzzlement at finding him here faded as I caught sight of the ship leaving the harbour, a narrow-hulled vessel of Maldinian design, sent to the northern reaches with an important passenger, one I knew he would miss greatly. He turned to regard my approach, a tight, wary smile on his lips, and I realized he had lingered to witness my own departure. Our interaction since the relief of Altor had been brief, somewhat terse in truth, distracted as he was by the ceaseless tumult of war and whatever malady had plagued him in the aftermath of his already legendary charge. The fatigue that turned his once strong features into a sagging mask of red-eyed lethargy, and his strident, if coarse, voice into a droning rasp. It had faded now, I could see. Recent battle seemed to have restored him somehow, making me wonder if he found some form of sustenance in blood and horror. "My lord?" He greeted me with a sketch of a formal bow, then nodded at my prisoner. "My lady?" Fornella returned the nod but gave no response, regarding him without expression as the salt-tinged wind tossed her hair, a single streak of grey visible amidst the reddish-brown tumult. "I have already received ample instruction," I began, but Alsona waved a hand. "I come to offer no instruction, my lord," he said. "Merely a farewell and my best wishes for your endeavour." I watched his expression as he waited for a response, the wary smile smaller now, his black eyes guarded. "Can it be?" I wondered. "Is he seeking forgiveness?" "Thank you, my lord," I replied, hefting the heavy canvas bag to my shoulder. "But we have a ship to board before the morning tide." "Of course. I'll accompany you." "We don't need a guard," Fornella said, her tone harsh. "I've given my word, tested by your truth-teller." It was true. We walked alone this morning without escort or formality. The reborn court of the unified realm had little time or inclination for ceremony. "Indeed, honored citizen," Alsona replied in clumsy and heavily accented Valerian. "But I have words for this greyclad." "Free man," I corrected before switching to realm tongue. "Greyclad denotes financial rather than social status." "Ah, quite so, my lord." He stepped aside and gestured for me to continue along the wharf to the quay where the ships waited, a long line of Maldinian war galleys and traders. Naturally, our vessel was moored at the farthest end of the line. "Brother Harlech's gift?" he inquired, nodding at the bag I carried. "Yes," I said. 15 of the oldest books in the great library, those I could identify as useful in the small time allowed in his archives. In truth, I had expected some argument from the brother librarian when I made my request, but the man had simply given an affable nod and barked an imperious order at one of his attendants to gather the requisite scrolls from the wagons that served as his movable library. I knew his apparent indifference to this theft was at least partly derived from his gift. He could always simply pen fresh copies, and openly, since the need to keep such things hidden had disappeared. The dark, as they called it, now revealed and discussed openly, the gifted free to practice their talents without fear of swift torment and execution, at least in theory. I could see the lingering fear on the faces of those not so talented, and the envy, making me wonder if perhaps the wisest course would have been to keep the gifted in the shadows. But could shadows ever linger in the fires of war? "You really think he's in there somewhere?" Alsona asked as we walked towards the ship. "The ally?" "An influence so malign and powerful is bound to leave traces," I said. "A historian is a hunter, my lord, seeking out signs in the undergrowth of correspondence and memoir, tracking prey via the spoor of memory. I don't expect to find a complete and unbiased history of this thing, be it beast or man or neither. but it will have left traces, and I intend to hunt it down. Then you should have a care, for I suspect it will not be blind to your attentions. Nor yours, I paused, glancing at his profile, seeing a troubled brow. Where's your certainty? I thought. It had been one of his most aggravating traits during our previous association. The implacable, unshakable surety. Now there was just a grim and troubled man, weighed down by the prospect of trials to come. Taking the capital will not be easy, I said. The wisest course would be to wait here, gathering strength until the spring. Wisdom and war are rare bedfellows, my lord. And you're right. The ally will most likely see it all. Then why? We simply cannot linger here and wait for the next blow to fall. Any more than your emperor can expect to remain immune from the allies' attentions. I am fully aware of what message to deliver to the emperor. The leather satchel bearing the sealed scroll was heavy about my neck, heavier even than my bag of books, though only a fraction of its weight. Just ink, paper, and wax, I thought. Yet it could send millions to war. We halted as we came to the ship, a broad-beamed Maldinian trader, her planking still scorched from the Battle of the Teeth, rails bearing the scars of blades and arrowheads, patches on the sails furled to the rigging. My eyes were also drawn to the serpentine figurehead, which, despite having lost much of its lower jaw, retained a certain familiarity. My gaze found the captain at the head of the gangplank, thick arms crossed, his face set in a glower, a face I recalled all too well. "Did you, perhaps, have a hand in choosing this vessel, my lord?" I asked Elsorna. There was a faint glimmer of amusement in his gaze as he shrugged. "Merely a coincidence, I assure you." I sighed, finding I had scant room in my heart for yet more resentment. Turning to Fornella and extending a hand to the ship. "Honored citizen, I'll join you in a moment." I saw Elsorna's eyes track her as she walked the plank to the ship, moving with her customary grace born of centuries-long practice. "Despite what the truth-teller said," he told me, "I caution you, don't trust her." I was her slave long enough to learn that lesson myself. I hefted my bag once again and nodded a farewell. "By your leave, my lord. I look forward to hearing the tale of your campaign." "You are right," he broke in. His wary smile returned once more. "The story I told you. There were some omissions." "I think you mean lies." "Yes." His smile faded. "But I believe you have earned the truth. I have scant notion of how this war will end, or even if either of us will live to see its end. But if we do, find me again, and I promise you'll have nothing but truth from me." I should have been grateful, I know. For what scholar does not hunger for truth from one such as he? But there was no gratitude as I looked into his gaze. No thought, save a name. Selisen. "I used to wonder," I said, "how a man who had taken so many lives could walk the earth unburdened by guilt. How does a killer bear the weight of killing and still call himself human? But we are both killers now, and I find it burdens my soul not at all. But then, I killed an evil man, and you a good one." I turned away and strode up the gangplank without a backward glance. Chapter 1. Lerna. She was woken by the snow, soft, icy caresses on her skin, tingling and not unpleasant, calling her from the darkness. It took a moment for memory to return, and when it did, she found it a fractured thing, fear and confusion reigning amidst the welter of image and sensation. Iltis roaring as he charged, sword bared, the ring of steel, a hard fist across her mouth, and the man who burned her. She opened her mouth to scream, but could issue no more than a whimper, her subsequent gasp dragging chilled air into her lungs. It seemed as if she would freeze from the inside out, and she felt it strange she should die from cold after being burned so fiercely. Iltis. The name was a sudden shout in her mind. Iltis is wounded. Perhaps dead. She willed herself to move, to get up, call for a healer with all the power her queen's voice could muster. Instead, she barely managed to groan and flutter her hands a little as the snow continued its frosty caress. Rage burned in her, banishing the chill from her lungs. "I need to move. I will not die in the snow like a forgotten dog." Drawing jagged air into her lungs again, she screamed, putting every ounce of strength and rage into the sound. A fierce scream, a queen's scream. But no more than a rattle of air through teeth when it reached her ears, along with something else.
"Better be a good reason for this, Sergeant," a hard voice was saying, strong, clipped and precise.
A soldier's voice, accompanied by the crunch of boots in snow.
"Taulord said he was to be minded well, Captain,"
another voice, coloured by an Ilsalin accent, older and not quite so strong.
"Treated with respect, he said, like the other folk from the point. And he seems fairly insistent, much as I can gather from a fellow that don't talk above two words at a time."
"Folk from the point," the captain said in a softer tone, "to whom we have to thank for a snowfall at summer's end." His voice faded, and the crunch of boots became the tumult of running men.
"Highness!"
Hands on her shoulders, soft but insistent.
"Highness, are you hurt? Do you hear me?"
Lerna could only groan, feeling her hands flutter once more.
"Captain Adal!"
The sergeant's voice choked and broken by fear.
"Her face!"
"I have eyes, Sergeant. Fetch the Tower Lord to Brother Kaelin's tent, and bring me men to carry his lordship. Say nothing of the Queen, you understand me?" More boots on the snow. Then she felt something warm and soft cover her from head to foot, her benumbed back and legs tingling as hands lifted her. She fell into darkness, untroubled by the jolting run of the captain as he bore her away. He was there when she awoke the second time, her eyes tracking over a canvas roof to find him sitting beside the cot where they had placed her. Although his eyes were tinged with the same red haze she had seen the day before, his gaze was brighter now, focused, the black eyes seeming to bore into the skin of her face as he leaned forward.
"He burned me."
She closed her eyes and turned away from him, stilling the sob in her chest, swallowing and composing herself before she turned back, finding him kneeling beside the cot, head lowered.
"Highness," he said.
She swallowed and tried to speak, expecting only a faint croak to emerge, but surprising herself with a somewhat strident response. "My Lord Alsorna, I trust the morning finds you well." His head came up, the expression sharp, the black eyes still fierce. She wanted to tell him it was rude to stare, at a queen no less, but knew it would sound churlish. "Every word must be chosen," her father had said once. "Each word spoken by the one who wears the crown will be remembered, often misremembered. So, my daughter, if ever you find this band of gold weighing upon your brow, never utter a single word that should not be heard from the mouth of a queen."
"Quite well, Highness,"
Velen responded, remaining on one knee as she stirred herself. To her surprise, she found she could move easily. Someone had removed the dress and cloak she wore the night before, replacing the finery with a simple cotton shift that covered her from neck to ankle, the fabric pleasing on her skin as she sat and swung her legs off the cot to sit up. "Please rise," she told Valen. "I find ceremony tedious at the best of times, and of scant use when we're alone." He stood, eyes never leaving her face. There was a hesitancy to his movements, a slight tremble to his hands as he reached for his chair, pulling it closer to sit opposite her, his face no more than an arm's length away, the closest they had been since that day at the summertide fair.
"Lord Iltis?" she asked.
"Wounded but alive," he said. "Also frostbitten in the small finger of his left hand. Brother Kellen was obliged to take it off. He barely seemed to notice, and it was quite the struggle to stop him charging forth to look for you.
I was fortunate in the friend's fate contrived to place in my path."
She paused, drawing breath and courage for what she had to say next. "We had little chance to talk yesterday. I know you must have many questions."
"One in particular," There are many wild tales abroad regarding your injuries. They say it happened when Malsius died.
Malsius was murdered by Brother Frentis of the Sixth Order. I killed him for it.
She saw the shock hit home as if she had slashed him with an ice-cold blade.
His gaze became distant as he slumped forward, speaking in a whisper.
Wanna be a brother? Wanna be like you?
There was a woman with him, Lerner went on. Like your brother, playing the role of an escaped slave, come all the way across the ocean with a grand tale of adventure. From her reaction when I killed him, I suspect their bond was close. Love can drive us to extremes.
He closed his eyes, controlling his grief with a shudder. Killing him would not have been easy.
My time with the Lonak left me skilled in certain areas. I saw him fall. After that,
the fire raked across her skin like the claws of a wildcat, filling her throat with the stench of her own flesh burning. It seems my memory has some limits after all.
Valen sat in silence for what seemed an age, lost in thought, his face even more gaunt than before.
It told me he was coming back, he murmured finally. But not for this.
I had expected you to request a different explanation, she said, keen to draw him back from whatever memories clouded his mind. For the way you were treated at Linesh.
No, Highness, he shook his head. I assure you I require no explanation at all.
The war was a grievous error. They had Malsius. My father's judgment was impaired.
I doubt King Janus's judgment was capable of impairment, Highness. And as for the war, you did try to warn me, as I recall.
She nodded, pausing to quiet her racing heart.
I was so sure he would hate me.
That man, she said. The man with the rope.
His name is Weaver, Highness.
Weaver, she repeated. I assume he was an agent of whatever malignancy is behind our current difficulties.
Hidden in your army, awaiting the time to strike.
Valen moved back a little, puzzlement replacing his grief.
Strike, Highness?
He saved me, she said, from that thing. Then he burned me. I confess I find it curious, though I'm learning these creatures have very strange ways. She faltered over a catch in her throat, recalling the fire that raged as the muscular young man pulled her close, the heat of it more intense even than that dreadful day in the throne room. She raised her head, forcing herself to meet his unwavering gaze.
Is it worse?
A faint sigh escaped him, and he reached across the divide to grasp her hands, rough, calloused palms against hers. She had expected some comforting clasp before he voiced the inevitable and terrible news, but instead he gripped her wrists and raised her hands, spreading the fingers to touch them to her face.
Don't! She said, trying to jerk away.
Trust me, Lerner, he breathed, pressing her fingers to the flesh, the smooth, undamaged flesh. Her fingers began to explore of their own volition as he took his hands away, touching every inch of skin, from her brow to her chin, her neck.
Where is it? She thought wildly, finding no rough, mottled scarring, provoking none of the searing pain that had continued to plague her, despite the healing balms her ladies applied to the burns every day.
Where's my face?
I knew Weaver had a great gift, Valen said. But this...
Lerner sat clutching her face, caging the sobs in her breast.
Every word must be chosen.
I... She began, faltered, then tried again. I should like you to convene a council of captains as soon as...
Then there was only the tears and the feel of his arms around her shoulders as she rested her head on his chest and wept like a child.
The woman in the mirror ran a hand over the pale stubble covering her head, a frown creasing her smooth brow.
It'll grow back, she knew. Maybe not keep it so long this time.
Lerner turned her attention to the skin where the burns had been most severe, finding the healing hadn't left her completely unmarked after all. There were faint, pale lines visible in the flesh around her eyes, thin and irregular tracks from her brow into her hairline. She recalled something the Malesa's poor, confused vessel had said that day beneath the mountain. "Not there yet. The marks of your greatness." Lerna stood back from the mirror a little, angling her head to study how the marks looked in the light from the tent opening, finding they faded somewhat in direct sunlight. Something shifted in the mirror, and she noticed Iltis over her shoulder, quickly averting his gaze, clutching the bandaged hand that protruded from the sleeve of his sling. He had shambled into the tent an hour ago, pushing Benton aside and collapsing to his knees before her. He had been stumbling through a plea for forgiveness when he glanced up and saw her face, falling to instant silence. "You should be abed, my lord," she told him. "I..." Iltis had blinked, tears shining in his eyes. "I will never leave your side, Highness. I gave my word." Am I his new faith? She wondered now, watching him in the mirror as he swayed a little, shaking his head and stiffening his back. The old one proved a disappointment, so now he finds devotion in me. The tent opening parted and Valin entered with a bow. "The army stands ready, Highness." "Thank you, my lord." She held out a hand to Orenna, who stood holding the hooded, fox-trimmed cloak she had chosen from the mountain of clothing Lady Reva had been overly pleased to provide. Orenna came forward and draped the cloak over her shoulders, whilst Morel knelt to proffer the impractical but elegant shoes for her royal feet. "Well," she said, stepping into the shoes and pulling the hood over her face, "let's be about it." Valin had placed a tall, uncovered wagon outside the tent, moving to it and holding out her hand as she approached. She clasped the hand and climbed onto the wagon, the cloak bunched in her free hand so as to prevent her tripping over it. The prospect of falling flat on her face at such a moment provoked a girlish giggle, suppressed before it could reach her lips. Every word must be chosen. She kept hold of Valin's hand as she stood surveying her new army. The plump brother from the Reaches had informed her, between stealing wide-eyed glances at her face, that the current complement of the Army of the North consisted of 60,000 men and women, plus somewhere in the region of 30,000 Siorda and Airhill warriors. The regiments were arrayed in ranks, mostly untidy and lacking the polished cohesion displayed by the Realm Guard during those interminable parades in Varenshold. In truth, the few Realm Guard present made a distinct contrast to their comrades, a tight, disciplined knot of denuded companies arrayed behind Brother Canis in the centre of the line. But the majority of her new army consisted of Count Marvin's Nilsalins, the conscripts Valin had marched from the Reaches, and the recruits gathered along the way. She saw little uniformity in their ranks, mismatched armour and weapons, much of it looted from the copious Valerian dead, makeshift flags lacking the colour and clarity of the Realm Guard's regimental banners. The Siorda had placed themselves on the right flank, a great throng of warriors standing in silence, curiosity the only apparent emotion. Behind them the Airhill waited, most mounted on their fine, tall horses, equally silent. Lady Reva had responded to Lerna's polite request for attendance with the full complement of her house guard, reduced to no more than 30 men, and seemingly all of her surviving archers. They stood in two long rows behind the Lady Governess, stocky, hard-eyed men with long bows slung across their backs. Lady Reva herself was flanked by her Lady Counselor, Lord Archer Antish, and the old bewhiskered guard commander, none of whom betrayed the slightest awe at Lerna's presence. Off to the left, the shield had brought the captains of the Meldinian fleet, shiplord El-Nurin deliberately standing a few feet in front of the shield, who stood with his arms crossed, inclining his head at her, habitual smile blazing as bright as ever. It was a pity, as she expected it to fade before long. Behind them all, the still-smoking city of Altor rose from its island, the twin spires of the cathedral partly obscured by the dusty snow that continued to fall. Lerna paused atop the wagon, her eyes picking out the diminutive but distinct form of Lady Dorena, standing in the front rank alongside Captain Adal and the North Guard. Unlike every other pair of eyes on this field, Lady Dorena's were fixed not on Lerna, but Valin. her gaze unblinking and unnerving in its intensity, making Lerna conscious of the warmth of his hand in hers. She released it and faced the army, reaching up to draw back her hood. It rippled through them like a cresting wave, a mingling of awed gasps, oaths, prayers, and outright shock, the already untidy ranks losing yet more cohesion as soldiers turned to their comrades in disbelief or amazement. However, she noted that the Sjorda and the Erhil remained silent, although their stance was now profoundly more alert. Lerna allowed the army's babble to build into a cacophony before holding up her hand. For a moment, it continued unabated, and she worried she might have to ask Valin to quiet them. But Captain Adal barked a command to his men, which was soon taken up by the officers and sergeants, silence descending on the ranks on swift wings. Lerna surveyed them, picking out faces, meeting their eyes, finding some unable to match her gaze, stirring in discomfort and lowering their heads, others staring back in blank astonishment. "I have not yet had chance to address you," she called to them, her voice strong and carrying well in the cold air. "For those that may be ignorant of my name, my list of titles is long, and I'll not bore you with it. Suffice to say that I am your queen, hailed as such by Tau Lord Alsorna and Lady Governess Reva of Cumbrail. Many of you saw me yesterday, and you will have seen a woman with a burnt face. Now you see a woman healed. I make you this promise as your queen. I will never lie to you. And so I tell you honestly that my face was healed by use of the dark. I claim no blessing from the departed, no favor from any god. I stand before you restored by the hand of a man with a gift I do not pretend to understand. This was done without my bidding or contrivance. However, I see no cause to regret it or punish the man who did me this service. Many of you will no doubt be aware that there are others within the ranks of this army with similar abilities, good and brave people who, by the strictures of our laws, are condemned to death for the gifts bestowed upon them by nature alone. Accordingly, all laws prohibiting use of the gifts once known as the dark are hereby rescinded under the Queen's word." She paused, expecting some upsurge of murmuring, some voices raised in discontent. Instead, there was only silence, each and every face now rapt, those that had shunned her gaze seemingly unable to look away. "Something stirs here," she realized. "Something useful." "There are none here who have not suffered," she spoke on. "There are none here who cannot lay claim to a murdered wife, husband, child, friend, or parent. Many of you have tasted the whip, as I have. Many of you have suffered the mauling of filthy hands, as I have. Many of you have burned, as I have." There was a growl building in the ranks now, a low rumble of stoked fury. She saw one woman in the middle of Captain Norta's company of freed slaves, slight and small but festooned with multiple daggers, her teeth bared in a burgeoning grimace of rage. "This land was named in honor of its unity," Lerna continued. "But only a fool would claim we have ever been truly united. Always we have shed our own blood in senseless feud after senseless feud. As of now, that ends. Our enemy came to these shores bringing slavery, torment, and death, but they also brought us a gift, one they'll regret for an eternity. They forged us into the unity that has eluded us for so long. They made us a single blade of unbreakable steel, aimed straight for their black heart, and with you at my side, I'll see it bleed." The growl erupted into a fierce shout, faces distorted in hate and anger, fists, swords, and halberds raised, the tumult washing over her, intoxicating in its power. Power. You have to hate it as much as you love it. She raised a hand, and they fell quiet once more, though there remained the low hum of simmering heat. "I promise no easy victories," she told them. "Our enemy is fierce and full of cunning.
They will not die easily. So I can promise only three things. Toil, blood, and justice. None who follow me on this path should imagine there will be any other reward. It was the small woman with the daggers who began the chant, stabbing the air with the blade in each hand, head thrown back. Toil, blood, and justice! It spread in an instant, the shout rising from one end of the army to the other. Toil, blood, and justice! Toil, blood, and justice! In 5 days we march for Varenthold, Lerna called as the chant continued, the pitch of its volume increasing yet further. She pointed towards the north. Never be afraid of a little theatre, the old schemer had said during one of the ceremonies where he handed out swords to ever less deserving recipients. Royalty is always a performance, daughter. The tumult doubled as she called again, her words lost in the rage-filled cheers. To Varenthold! She stood for a few moments, arms spread wide in the center of their adoring rage. Did you ever have this, father? Did they ever love you? The noise continued as she descended from the wagon, reaching for Valen's hand again, but pausing at the sight of the shield. As expected, his smile was gone, replaced by a somber frown, making her wonder if he still intended to follow her anywhere. Varenthold lies over 200 miles distant, Highness, Count Marvin told her, and we have barely enough grain to sustain the horses for 50. Our Cumbrellian friends were most efficient in denuding this land of supplies. Better burnt than in the belly of our enemies, Lady Reva pointed out from across the table. They were arrayed around a large map table in Valen's tent. All the principal captains of the army along with Lady Reva and the war chiefs from the Airhill and Siorda. The Airhill was a wiry rider somewhere past his 50th year by her reckoning. The Siorda was slightly younger, taller than most of his people, lean as a wolf with a hawk face. They seemed to understand every word spoken, but said little themselves. And she noted how their gaze flitted constantly between her and Valen. Is it suspicion, she thought, or just wonder? Count Marvin had spent the better part of an hour explaining their strategic situation. Never having had much use for the tedium of military history, she was obliged to pick out the pertinent details from the morass of jargon. From what she could gather, it seemed their position was not as favourable as a queen might expect after winning so great a victory. Quite so, my lady, the Count told Reva. But it does leave us perilously short of supplies, with winter only 2 months away into the bargain. Am I to understand, my lord? Lerna said. We have a mighty army, but no means to move it anywhere? The Count ran a hand over his shaven head, the stitched scar on his cheek seeming to glow a little more red as he sighed his frustration and sought to formulate the correct response. Yes, Valen told her from the opposite end of the table. And it's not just a matter of moving it. If we don't find sufficient forage for the winter, this army could well starve. Surely we have captured Valerian supplies, Lerna said. Indeed, Highness, plump Brother Hollum spoke up. Like most present, he seemed to have difficulty in not staring at her face. 12 tons of grain, 4 of corn, and 6 of beef. Without which my people will starve this winter, Lady Reva stated. I've had to start rationing again already, Highness, she added, clearly still having trouble with etiquette. Lerna looked at the map, tracing the route to Varenthold, finding many towns and villages along the way, but knowing most would now be little more than scorched ruins, devoid of any supplies. 200 miles to Varenthold, she mused, studying the map more closely. Half that to the coast and the sea. She looked up, finding the shield standing outside the circle of captains, towards the rear of the tent, his face half in shadow. My Lord Elnestra, she said. Your counsel, please. He came forward after a moment's hesitation. Fief Lord Dravis's twin grandsons making room for him, with courteous bows he failed to acknowledge. Highness, he said in a neutral tone. There are many ships in your fleet, she said. Enough to carry an army to Varenthold? He shook his head. Half the fleet was obliged to return to the Isles for repairs after the teeth. We could perhaps carry a third of the number gathered here, and even then we would have to leave the horses behind.
Varenshold won't fall to so few, Count Marvin said. Not if the Valerian woman is to be believed. They are well garrisoned and supplied from across the sea and from Renfale.
Lerna switched her gaze to Varenshold, the capital and principal port of the entire realm, much of its wealth in fact drawn from trade with Valeria. She pointed to the sea lanes off Varenshold and looked up at the shield. Ever take a ship in these waters, my lord? He considered the map for a moment, then nodded.
A few?
Not such easy pickings as in the southern trade routes. The king's fleet was always a watchful shepherd for Varenshold's trade.
Now there is no fleet, Lerna pointed out. And the pickings are likely to be rich, are they not, given the enemy's losses at the teeth?
He nodded again.
Rich indeed, Highness.
You gave me a ship yesterday. Today I give her back to you, with a request you take your fleet and seize or burn any Valerian ship you find journeying to or from Varenshold. Will you do this for me?
She felt the other captain stirring, hard gazes turning on the pirate.
Don't like to see a queen bargain, she decided. I'll speak to him in private in future.
My men may take some persuasion, he responded after a moment. We sailed to defend the Isles, and that task is done.
Shiplord Elnurin stepped forward, bowing to her with accomplished grace.
I can't speak for the shield's men, Highness, but my men are ready to follow you to Udenor's halls if you ask, as I'm sure will many more. After the Battle of the Teeth, and your healing, many wouldn't dare refuse.
He turned to the shield with an expectant expression.
As the shiplord says, the shield grated after a moment, how could we refuse?
Very well. Lerna scanned the map once more. Preparations must be complete within the week, whereupon the army will march not north, but east, to the coast. We will proceed to Varenshold via the coastal ports, where our Meldinian allies will resupply us with whatever riches the Valerian ruling council deems fit to send its garrison. Also, ports means fishing folk, who I'm sure will be glad of the custom.
If there are any left, Rivas said softly.
I hereby make the following appointments, Lerna went on, choosing to ignore the lady governess. Please forgive the lack of ceremony, but we have no time for such pettiness now. I name Lord Valin Alsorna as Battle Lord of the Queen's Host. Count Marvin is named Sword of the Realm and Adjutant General. Brother Holland, I name you Keeper of the Queen's Purse. Captains Adal, Orvin, and Norta are hereby made Swords of the Realm and elevated to the rank of Lord Marshal. Lord Atheron El Nestra. She met the shield's gaze once more. I name you Fleet Lord of the Unified Realm and Captain of its flagship. She cast her gaze around the assembly. These appointments include all due rights and privileges set down by realm law, with grants and lands to be allotted at the close of hostilities. I ask you formally, do you accept these honours? She noted Valin was the last to voice his assent, and then only after the shield had taken a seeming age to bow in agreement, a ghost of his usual smile on his lips.
Other business, lords and good sirs? She asked the council.
There is the matter of the prisoners, Highness, Lord Marshal Orvin said. Keeping them safe is proving a trial, especially given the bow skills of our Cumbrainian hosts, he added with a glance in Reva's direction. They have been screened for useful intelligence, I assume? Lerna asked. Harlech, the thin older brother, raised a bony hand. That task was given to me, Highness. There are a few officers among them I've yet to question, though my experience to date indicates their usefulness is likely to be limited.
They can work, Valin said, meeting her gaze with red-rimmed but steady eyes. Rebuild what they destroyed.
I can't have them in the city, Reva put in, shaking her head. The people will tear them apart.
Then we take them with us, Valin responded. They can act as porters.
And more mouths to feed, Lerna said, turning to Brother Harlech. Complete your questioning, brother. Lord Marshal Orvin will hang them when you're done. My lords and sirs, to your duties, if you please. She found him sitting by the river, seemingly no more than a well-built soldier, plaiting rope with unusually nimble fingers. Valiant had warned her not to expect much from him, so it was a surprise when he scrambled to his feet as she approached, performing a bow of such perfection it would have shamed the most accomplished courtier. "Kara said I should bow," he told her, his broad, handsome face lit by an open smile. "Showed me how." Lerna glanced off to the right where the three other gifted from the Reaches looked on. The girl Kara, still pale and tired by her exertions the day before, regarded Lerna with a suspicious frown, matched by the skinny young man who held her hand and the hulking fellow with copious hair who stood behind them both. "Do they think I come to punish?" Benton put a hand on his sword as Weaver came closer, reaching out to touch her face. "It's all right, my lord," she told the former fisherman, standing still and allowing the healer's hand to play over her features. "It burned before, but now it's cold." "I came to offer my thanks, sir," she told Weaver. "I would name you a lord." "Your reward is already given," he said, withdrawing his hand. His face lost its smile, his brow creased with confusion as he tapped a finger to it. "Always the way, something comes back." His gaze widened a little as he stared into her eyes. "You gave more. More than any other." Lerna experienced a bout of the same near panic that had gripped her at the Malessa's mountain, the desire to run from something unknowable but undeniably dangerous. She exhaled slowly and forced herself to meet his gaze. "What did I give?" He smiled again, turning away to sit once more, reaching for his rope. "Yourself," he said in a faint voice as his hands resumed their work. "My queen." She turned to find Iltis marching towards her, his face paler than she would have liked, but he still refused to rest. Beyond him, she could see Brother Canis standing with four common folk, two young women from the city, an Ilsalian soldier, and one of Lord Norta's free fighters. Lerna saw the three gifted from the Reaches stiffen at the sight of them, exchanging worried glances, the big one even hefting the quarterstaff he carried and stepping protectively in front of the girl. "Lord Marshal Canis requests a private audience, Highness," Iltis told her with a bow. She nodded and beckoned Canis forward, moving a short distance away from Weaver. She paused a moment to view the frozen waters of the Cold Iron, then glanced over at Kara, now glaring in naked animosity at Brother Canis as he fell to one knee before her. The power to freeze a river in summer. But she fears this man. "Highness, I crave your attention." "Yes, yes, brother." She waved him to his feet, gesturing at Kara and the other gifted. "You seem to be making my subjects nervous." Brother Canis turned to the gifted, grimacing a little. "They fear what I have to tell you." He faced her, straightening his back. "My queen, I come to offer the services of my order in this conflict. We subject ourselves to your commands and shirk no duty in pursuit of victory. I have never doubted the loyalty of the Sixth Order, brother, though I wish I had more of you." Lerna trailed off as she looked again at the group of common folk, seeing how they shifted under her scrutiny, every face tense and wary. "These folk do not strike me as likely recruits for the Sixth." "No, Highness," he said, and she had a sense of a man forcing himself to a long-feared duty. "We belong to another order entirely." Chapter 2. Alusius. The Curitae's name was 27, though Alusius had yet to hear him say it. In fact, he had yet to hear the slave elite say anything. He reacted to instruction with instant obedience, and was the perfect servant, fetching, carrying, and cleaning with no sign of fatigue or even the faintest expression of complaint. "My gift to you," Lord Danel had said that day they had dragged Alusius from the depths of the Black Hold, expecting death and gasping in astonishment when they removed his shackles
and he found his own father's hands helping him to his feet. "A servant of peerless perfectitude," Darnell went on, gesturing at the curatai. "You know, I think I'm growing fond of your wordsmithing ways, little poet." "Yes, I'm very well this fine morning," Aloysius told 27 as he laid out the breakfast. "How nice of you to ask." They were on the veranda overlooking the harbour. The sun rising over the horizon to paint the ships a golden hue he knew would have sent Alornis scurrying to fetch her canvas and brushes. He had chosen the house for the view. A merchant's domicile, no doubt, its owner presumably dead or enslaved along with his family. Varenshold was full of empty houses now. More to choose from should he grow tired of this one. But he found himself too fond of the view, especially as it covered the entirety of the harbour. Fewer and fewer ships, he thought, counting the vessels with accustomed precision. 10 slavers, 5 traders, 4 warships. The slavers sat highest in the water, their copious holds empty, as they had been for weeks, ever since the great column of smoke had risen to blot the sun from the sky for days on end. Aloysius had been trying to write something about it, but found the words failed to flow every time he put pen to paper. How does one write a eulogy for a forest? 27 placed the last plate on the table and stood back, as Aloysius reached for his cutlery, tasting the mushrooms first, finding them cooked to perfection with a little garlic and butter. "Excellent as always, my deadly friend." 27 stared out of the window and said nothing. "Ah, yes. It's visiting day." Aloysius went on around a mouthful of bacon. "Thank you for reminding me. Pack the salve and the new books, if you would." 27 instantly turned away and went about his instructions, moving to the bookcase first. The house's owner had maintained a reasonable library, largely, Aloysius assumed, for appearance's sake, as few of the volumes showed much sign of having ever been read. They were mostly popular romances, and a few of the more well-known histories, none suited to his purposes, which obliged him to spend hours ransacking the larger houses for more interesting material. There was much to choose from. The Valerians were boundlessly enthusiastic looters, but had little interest in books, save as kindling. Yesterday had been particularly fruitful, netting a complete set of Mariel's astronomical observations and an inscribed volume he hoped would arouse the interest of one of his charges in particular. 10 slavers, 5 traders, 4 warships, he counted again, turning to the harbour. 2 less than yesterday. He paused as another vessel came into view, a warship rounding the headland to the south. It seemed to be struggling to make headway through the water. Only one sail raised, and that, he saw as it came closer, was a ragged thing of soot-blackened canvas. The ship trailed, sagging rope through the placid morning swell, as it neared the harbour mouth. Blocks and shattered beams hanging from her rigging, sparse crew moving about the deck with the stoop of exhausted men. As she weighed anchor, Aloysius's eyes picked out numerous scorch marks blackening her hull, and many dark brown stains on her untidy deck. 5 warships, he corrected himself. One with an interesting tale to tell, it seems. They stopped off at the pigeon coop on the way, finding his sole remaining bird in typically hungry mood. "Don't bolt it," he cautioned Bluefeather with a wagging finger, but she ignored him, head bobbing as she pecked at the seeds. The coop was situated atop the house of the Blockers' Guild. The roof spared the fires that had gutted the building, thanks to its iron-beamed construction. The surrounding houses hadn't been so fortunate, and the once busy building where he had come to have his poems printed now rose from streets of rubble and ash. Seen from this vantage point, the city resembled a grimy patchwork, islands of intact buildings in a sea of grey-black ruins. "Sorry if you're finding it lonely these days," he told Bluefeather, stroking her fluffy breast. There had been 10 of them to begin with a year ago. Young birds, each with a tiny wire clasp about their right leg, strong enough to hold a message. This had been the first place he had hurried to on release from the Black Hold, finding only 3 birds still alive. He fed them and disposed of the corpses as 27 looked on impassively. It had been a risk, leading the slave here to witness his greatest secret. But there was little choice. In truth, he had expected the curatai to either cut him down on the spot, or shackle him once more for immediate return to captivity. Instead, he just stood and watched as Eleusis scribbled the coded message on a tiny scrap of parchment before rolling it up and sliding it into the small metal cylinder that would fit onto the bird's leg clasp.
"Barents hold fallen," he had written, though he knew it was probably old news to the recipients. "Darnell rules. 500 knights and 1 V division."
27 didn't even turn to watch the bird fly away when Eleusis cast it from the rooftop, and the expected death blow had never fallen. Not then, and not when he released the next bird the night the Valerian fleet set sail for the Meldinian Isles. 27, it appeared, was neither his jailer nor Darnell's spy. He was simply his waiting executioner. In any case, his worries over what the Curatai saw had long since faded, along with the hope he might live to see the city liberated, and watch Alornis draw again. He briefly considered sending Blue Feather with his final message. Those he reported to would no doubt find the news of the ragged warship interesting, but decided against it. The ship portended a great deal, and it would be better to await discovery of the full story before expending his last link to the outside world. They climbed down from the rooftop via the ladder on the back wall, making for the only building in Varenshold that seemed to have suffered no damage at all, the squat fortress of black stone sitting in the center of the city. There had been a bloody battle here, he knew, the Blackhold's garrison of Fourth Order thugs putting up a surprisingly good fight as they beat back successive waves of Varitai, Aspect Tendris in the thick of the fight, spurring them on to ever greater feats of courage with unwavering faith. At least that's how the story went if you believed the mutterings of the realm-born slaves. It had finally fallen when the Curatai were sent in, Aspect Tendris cutting down 4 of the slave elite before a dastardly knife in the back laid him low, something Eleusis found extremely unlikely, though he did concede the mad bastard had probably gone down fighting. The Varitai at the gate stepped aside as he approached, 27 in tow, with his books and various medicines in a sack over his broad shoulder. The interior of the Blackhold was even less edifying than its exterior, a narrow courtyard within grim black walls, Varitai archers posted on the parapet above. Eleusis went to the door at the rear of the courtyard, the Varitai guard unlocking it and stepping aside. Inside he followed the damp, winding steps down into the vaults. The smell provoked unwelcome memories of his time here, musty rot mingling with the sharp tang of rat piss. The steps ended some 20 feet down, opening out into a torchlit corridor lined by 10 cells, each sealed with a heavy iron door. The cells had all been occupied when he was first brought here. Now all but 2 stood empty.
"No," Eleusis replied to 27's unvoiced question.
"I can't say it is good to be back, my friend." He went to the free sword seated on a stool at the end of the corridor. It was always the same man, a sour-faced fellow of brawny build, who spoke realm tongue with all the finesse of a blind mason attempting to carve a masterpiece.
"Which un?"
he grunted, getting to his feet and putting aside a wineskin. "Aspect Dendrish, I think," Eleusis replied. "Irksome duties first, I always say." He concealed a sigh of frustration at the free sword's baffled frown. "The fat man," he added slowly. The free sword shrugged and moved to the door at the far end of the corridor, keys jangling as he worked the lock. Eleusis thanked him with a bow and went inside. Aspect Dendrish Hendril had lost perhaps half his famous weight during captivity, but that still made him considerably fatter than most men. He greeted Eleusis with the customary scowl and lack of formality, small eyes narrowed and gleaming in the light from the single candle in the alcove above his bed. "I trust you've brought me something more interesting than last time."
"I believe so, Aspect."
Eleusis took the sack from 27 and rummaged inside, coming out with a large volume, the title embossed in gold on the leather binding.
"Fallacy and Belief," the Aspect read as he took the volume. "The Nature of God Worship. You bring me my own book?"
"Not quite, Aspect. I suggest you look inside." Dendrish opened the book, his small eyes peering at the text scribbled on the title page, which Eleusis knew read, "Or, Pomposity and Arrogance, The Nature of Aspect Hendril's Scholarship."
"What is this?" the Aspect demanded.
"I found it at Lord Al Avern's house," Lucius told him. "You remember him, no doubt. They called him the Lord of Ink and Scroll, on account of his scholarly accomplishments."
"Accomplishments? The man was an amateur, a mere copier of greater talents."
"Well, he has much to say on your talents, Aspect. His critique of your treatise on the origin of the Alperan gods is particularly effusive, and quite elegantly phrased, I must say."
Hendril's plump hands leafed through the book with expert precision, opening it out to reveal a chapter liberally adorned with the late Lord Al Avern's graceful script.
"Simply repeats Carvel," the Aspect read in a furious rasp. "This empty-brained ape accuses me of lacking originality?"
"I thought you might find it amusing." Lucius bowed again and moved to the door.
"Wait!"
Hendril cast a wary glance at the free sword standing outside, and levered himself to his feet, not without difficulty.
"You must have news, surely."
"Alas, things have not changed since my last visit, Aspect. Lord Darnell hunts for his son through the ashes of his great crime. We await news of General Tokrev's glorious victory at Altor, and Admiral Morok's equally glorious seizure of the Meldinian Isles."
Hendril moved closer, speaking in a barely heard whisper.
"Master Greylin? Still no word on him?"
It was the one question he always asked, and Lucius had given up trying to extract the reason for this interest in the Sixth Order's Storminder.
"None, Aspect. Just like last time."
Oddly, this response always seemed to reassure the Aspect, and he nodded, moving back to sit on his bed, his fingers resting on the book, not looking up as Lucius left the cell. As ever, Aspect Alera proved a contrast to her brother in the faith, smiling and standing as the door swung open, her slender hands extended in greeting. "Lucius."
"Aspect?"
He always found he had to force the catch from his voice when he saw her, clad in her filthy grey robe they wouldn't let him replace, the flesh of her ankle red and raw from the shackle. But she always smiled, and she was ever glad to see him.
"I brought more salve," he said, placing the sack on the bed, "for your leg. There's an apothecary shop on Drover's Way, burnt out naturally, but it seems the owner had the foresight to hide some stock in his basement."
"Resourceful as ever, good sir. My thanks."
She sat and rummaged through the sack for a moment, coming out with the small ceramic pot of salve, removing the lid to sniff the contents.
"Cawtry oil and honey. Excellent. This will do very well."
She rummaged further and found the books.
"Mariel!" she exclaimed in a delighted gasp. "I once had a full set. Must be near 20 years since my last reading."
"You are good to me, Lucius."
"I endeavour to do my best, Aspect."
She set the book aside and looked up at him, her face as clean as her meagre water ration allowed. Lord Darnell had been very particular in his instructions regarding her confinement, a consequence of her less than complimentary words during his first and only visit here. So, whilst Aspect Dendrish was treated to only the cruelty of indifference and a restricted diet, Aspect Alera was shackled to the wall with a length of chain that restricted her movements to no more than 2 square feet of her tiny cell. As yet, however, he had not heard her voice a single complaint.
"How goes the poem?" she asked him.
"Slowly, Aspect. I fear these tumultuous times deserve a better chronicler."
"A pity. I was looking forward to reading it."
"And your father?"
"Sends his regards," Lucius lied. "Though I see him rarely these days, busy as he is with the Lord's work."
"Ah, well, be sure to pass along my respects."
At least she won't call him traitor when this is done, he thought. Though she may be the only one.
"Tell me, Lucius," she went on, "do your explorations ever take you to the southern quarter?"
"Rarely, Aspect. The pickings are hardly rich, and in any case, there's little of it left to pick through."
"Pity. There was an inn there, the Black Boar, I believe it was called. If you're in need of decent wine, I believe the owner kept a fine selection of Cumbrian vintages in a secret place beneath the floorboards, so as not to trouble the king's excisemen, you understand."
"Decent wine? How long had it been since he had tasted anything but the most acid vinegar? The Valerians may have had little interest in the city's books, but it scraped